friends. Welcome to the 10 Laws with East Forest podcast. I'm East Forest, and happy spring. We're moving into spring here. This March 22nd, well, the 20th is the spring equinox, and on the 22nd is the release of Ram Dass Chapter 2 as we move into a new season. And on the equinox, on the 20th, is a full moon, and it's at 4 p.m., the equinox mountain time, and at 5 p.m. mountain time, I'm doing my release event here at the Treefort Music Fest at the El Kara Shrine. I can never say that, like, certainly not one time in a row. El Kara Shrine. It's a Shriners venue. It's actually one of the best venues at Treefort. It's my favorite. It's large. It has one of the best systems at the entire festival. And I can't wait to be first in there because we get to do a ceremony concert and the floor will be clean. So you can lie down, you can sit, you can go fully into that experience. And I can't wait to share that with you. That is March 20th here in Boise. You can get tickets at the door as they're available, but you can come in with a Treefort Festival Pass or a Yoga Fort Pass if you have one of those. And I'll be at Yoga Fort on Friday and Saturday as well, doing sets with Tony G and Marissa Rada Wepner. But there are four new songs coming out in Ram Dass Chapter 2. One of them was premiered on Relics Magazine. They premiered the song Home, which Ram Dass talks about his first experience with psilocybin. And that was actually a really funny experience because when I was in Maui asking him the questions, I asked a long-winded question about psilocybin, mushrooms, how it's this new burgeoning field of therapy, and there's Michael Pollan's new book, Changing Our Minds, and so forth and so on. And he listens patiently. And when I'm finished, he stares off and he smiles and he says, "Psilocybin is my friend," which is classic Ram Dass. It's sardonic and perfect and poetic and funny and sets up his story. And it's just wonderful. So that's the story Home, which is out now. I think it's just on my website, eastforest.org and SoundCloud, but it'll come out with the rest of Chapter 2 on Spotify, iTunes, all that stuff on Friday the 22nd. So are you interested? Are you going to be hosting a listening gathering, a listening party on the 22nd? We did this with Chapter 1 and we encourage you to do it for Chapter 2. It's just a way to gather with your friends or your community or the public, however you'd like to move forward, and dive deeper into the themes that come up that Ram Dass presents in these songs. So we'll give you lyrics and some background material and stuff to help you make an event, but you can do it however you want. So if you'd like to do that and you want our help, email info@eastforest.org, O-R-G, and we'll send you that material probably the day before the event, and we'll help you as we can. But we're just encouraging us to get some face time with our community, with our friends, to gather and celebrate the release of Chapter 2, East Forest Ram Dass. So that is coming up. Today, I have a conversation with Julie Holland. And Julie is someone that has come across my orbit with some different friends. And she's been introducing me to different researchers and stuff in the psychedelic therapy world, which she is connected to. And we do get to talk about that a little bit. But she's a psychiatrist based in New York City, New York State. And we get into some really interesting subjects about the brain and diet and moods and depression and technology, some thoughts about where psychedelic therapy is at right now. And we even get into relationships and sex and the brain, and it was awesome. So I can't wait to talk to her again sometime in the future because she's definitely a wealth of knowledge and just a lovely being. Before we get into that, please thank you in advance. Give this podcast a review. Give it 5 stars. Write a little comment. We haven't had a little comment review in a bit, and so it means a lot. Just go down there and do it now while I'm talking. It just takes a few seconds. And even better, share a podcast you like on social media. Send it to your friends. Talk about it and help this grow. This is a gift that I do, something I just put out there and put my time into because I really enjoy doing it. And if you enjoy it, It's a wonderful energy to help that energy just continue to flow out. So I added a couple live dates. I won't go through them all, but they're over at eastforest.org/tour. I am kicking off after this date here on Wednesday the 20th in Boise, Idaho. At the end of March, I'll be out in Texas. And then I'm heading out to the East Coast. So there's some stuff over there in like Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York City on April 13th. But I'll be up there in a little bit of Massachusetts, upstate New York after that, and then out to Chicago on the 20th of April. And then I'm adding a new section in June that goes down the West Coast. So there's some stuff in Portland coming on June 1st, San Francisco down through Mammoth, Esalen again, of course, for the retreat there at the solstice. All the way down there. So some new stuff coming, more stuff being added. And if you'd like to maybe see about hosting an East Forest ceremony event, you can reach out at that info at eastforest.org or booking at eastforest.org. And I mentioned last time that we also just added back the East Forest Fall Retreat in Southern Utah. That's sort of our flagship retreat that we do out there in the wilderness. It's a wilderness and wellness retreat. And that's September 26th through 29th. You can sign up just on my website, eastforest.org. And that one's kind of limited in size. So if you're interested in going, you should sign up in advance. It's a fairly intimate retreat and one where we really get a chance to dive into nature and music. And most importantly, one another. All right. So I am coming to you from where the sunshine is shining down. I'm definitely feeling the change of the season. I'm getting back in my game here with performing. So I'm going to get to some rehearsal here in a second. I was also just out in Atlanta the last couple of days recording a featured artist for Chapter 3 of the Ram Dass. I don't want to tell you who it is yet because, you know, it's not like in the bag totally. But it's one of those things where like I flew out, got up, crack of dawn. Flew out, landed, went straight to the studio, recorded, left the studio at 3 a.m., crashed, and then went right back to the airport and flew back. It was nutty. I'm still resolving from that one, but I'll tell you more stories about that when we get it totally wrapped up. But it's been really, really interesting bringing these other folks on board and hearing their point of view as we mix it in with Ram Dass's words and the music. And I love watching the songs pop up to like another level and just reach this whole new space when we add in another person's voice and their perspective. So I can't wait to share it with you. But fortunately for Chapter 2, you don't have to wait too much longer. It's just like a couple days and it'll be out. It'll actually be out Thursday night, probably around 10, 11 p.m. That's how they do it. Okie dokie, folks. Here it is, Julie Holland. Enjoy. Hi, Julie.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. I assume you're in New York City?
Okay, it's good afternoon, but only like by a minute or two. But yeah, I'm actually in the country north of New York City.
Oh, I went to college in Poughkeepsie, so I don't know how far up you are, but I'm fond of the area.
That same latitude. I'm just east of Poughkeepsie. Yeah, and it's forests and rocks and trees and hawks and eagles. It's really beautiful here.
Is this like a second home or is that your primary residence?
Well, it was a second home and then we discovered how therapeutic it was to be out in nature and live in a small town and have like a tightly knit community. And so after 8 years of going back and forth between like a country home and a city home, we just decided to live here full time.
Yeah, I lived in New York City for almost 10 years and now I live in a town of 200 people
yeah.
in Southern Utah. So I sort of had a trajectory like that where I started to value just, you know, that sort of small town community. It's not something I had growing up ever. And
me so it's neither.
Been a,
yeah.
a good experience.
I grew up in a huge town, actually the biggest town in America, which is Framingham, Massachusetts. They finally turned it into a city, but it was a town when I was growing up. And then I went to undergrad and med school in Philly, and then I did all my training and work in New York City. So this was real culture shock for me to be up here. There's a lot less diversity. There's, you know, sort of one political party. There was like no Democrats basically when we got here.
Oh, yeah.
So, but I, you know, I like, I really like being out in nature and having that be a constant option. And my last book, Moody Bitches, one of the things I wrote a lot about was how living in a city really is not very healthy for you, sort of physically or psychiatrically. And I encourage my patients to just even just go to Central Park or, you know, take a train, just get off a couple stops out of the city just to remember that you're on a planet and, you know, try to put your bare feet on the ground and look at a butterfly and just kind of slow down. There's a pace in New York City, which is ridiculous. That most of the world doesn't operate at that pace.
No. It also is interesting how, particularly Manhattan, you know, it's a grid and you're in this lifestyle where you're sort of moving in these right angles and everything is covered over by man, like pavement or even the parks are, we've sort of built them and designed them. And it changes perhaps the way you're thinking about things. Your experience of life is sort of very man-made.
Yeah. And I would say those angles and that kind of linearity or, you know, I sort of think of that as more yang than yin. And I think of being out in nature, you know, and you're sort of operating in like geological time and not work time. And it's just a completely different perspective. And I also think that it shifts your body into a different mode. I mean, the book that I'm working on now is really trying to sort of narrow down this, what happens to your body when you are relaxed and you feel connected. You know, sometimes in New York City, even though there's people all around you in the elevator and the subway, there is this isolation. You know, everybody is staring in their phone. Everybody's working in their cubicle.
Yes.
There's a disconnection. And I'm trying to write about sort of how the body responds to being disconnected versus being connected. You know, we all learned about the fight or flight response. I mean, like, you know, from middle school to med school, I must have learned about it a dozen times. Like it was always coming up, fight or flight. And that's important for survival, but it's not the only thing that we need for survival. And the whole other sort of flip side of fight or flight is the parasympathetic nervous system where we're resting and digesting and repairing. That's the only time that the body really does any kind of repair or rejuvenation is when you're in this rest and digest mode. And the behavior that sort of characterizes the rest and digest mode as opposed to fight or flight is this tend and befriend behavior where you're cultivating relationships and you're sort of thriving with connection. And I think one of the reasons why we sort of have an opiate, not sort of, we absolutely have an opiate epidemic and a suicide epidemic and all these sort of diseases of despair that are increasing and our life expectancy is decreasing. And I think that's all a reflection of the isolation and loneliness that actually keeps our bodies in the fight or flight mode. You know, we're not meant to be disconnected and it is read as a threat to our safety if we're disconnected. You know, there's safety in numbers. So, you know, it just adds to the stress that the body has to deal with when you're isolated and disconnected. And I think one of our major disconnections is from nature. Certainly in the city, we're disconnected from nature. But I would also say that we're really disconnected from ourselves. And that's where your work really comes in, is to sort of forge the connection within ourselves back to ourselves and get grounded and have some integrity just as like a single unit that has some sort of, you know, connection or unification, even just as a sole proprietor of your body.
It's a hallelujah. You're like, wow, this is sweet. It's like we're on the same page. You know, a couple things came up in what you just said, and I don't want to get too far off on tangents, but I was thinking about this idea of, you know, the suicide epidemic and things of this. That's something that's very close to my heart. And this general feeling of malaise and disconnection, while at the same time, there's this information explosion on the planet. And I've spent a lot of time thinking about technology as a just sort of a thing and how it integrates into our lives and how it makes our lives better. I mean, here you and I are talking through means of new technology, and we're disseminating this information through podcasting, new technology.
Right.
But like any tool, there does seem to be, in my gut, it certainly feels this way, a connection between the use of this stuff and our sense of disconnection, which is ironic, given especially with social media, the whole point of it is connecting to more people. I know for me, I've spoken about this a lot, but I have had to distance myself from social media because I quite clearly don't feel well when I use it.
Right.
I feel worse.
Yeah.
And so what's, you know, what, how do you feel about this, just technology in general as a means of pushing us away from ourselves and what we do?
It totally feels like a bait and switch, the social media. You know, the reason that we reach for our phones or we get on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram is that we want to feel connected, that we want to see what our friends are doing and we want to feel connected to them. And that's the allure of the phone or the laptop, is this promise of connection. But it's a synthetic connection. It leaves us wanting more. You know, this one of the things that leads to addiction is when it almost gives you what you need. It scratches around an itch. You know, you can never get enough of something that almost works. And I think that the reason why we are just have our heads in our phones and we're scrolling is that we're not getting what we need. It's the promise of connection, but it, because it's so synthetic, because there's no eye contact, there's no touch, there's no hugging, there's no pheromones, there's no, you know, if you buy into this idea that people sort of have like an aura or an electromagnetic field around them, which I definitely buy into that. There's none of that, obviously, you know, when you're emailing or texting, and eye contact and touch and smelling each other and taking each other in, we don't get any of that. And we're built for that. We're built for that physiological connection and that actual sort of synchronization of our electromagnetic fields, of our auras, of our eye contact. You know, that is what we're built for. And that is what soothes us and satisfies us. And being held, physically held and comforted, shifts your body over into that rest and digest and repair, tend and befriend mode. And we're not getting that from our screens. We want it. We're starving for it, but we're really not getting it. And it's just like a junkie where you think you're going to get, you know, what's going to fix you, and it never really does. And you just keep, you think that that quantity will make up for quality. But just the act of being on our phones or being on our laptops means that we're not with other people, that we're isolated. You know, we are screened off from connection in those states. And it's killing us. And I would say literally killing us. I mean, more people are getting hit by cars and dying because they're on their phones. More people are dying in the car because they're on their phones. It's affecting our posture. It's affecting our moods. It's making us fat. You know, a teenage boy is supposed to be out hunting wild boar for the tribe. But instead he's sitting on a couch, you know, with a bag of Doritos, while his brain thinks that he is hunting because he's playing a video game. It's not good for our bodies. It's not good for society. And, you know, we're paying the price now, and I'm afraid it's going to get worse.
Have you seen these places where you can pay someone to cuddle with you?
Yeah, it's real. I have a daughter who was very much raised with attachment parenting, and you know, we co-slept forever, and she was on, you know, she was in a baby Bjorn on me or on my husband, nursing on demand, and you know, she's a cuddler, and I'm a cuddler, and you know, she jokes about like if she can't find work, she knows she could always be a professional cuddler. So yeah, we're very aware that that's a thing, and that not only do people pay to be held by people pay to be held by animals. I've seen articles where people will want to lie down with cows or cuddle up with horses. Yeah, we're starving for touch, you know, and maybe that has a little bit to do with how like crazy we are with sex right now too, is that we all really need it. It's a very basic human need and a basic human drive for skin to skin contact. And the book that I'm writing now is a lot about oxytocin,
Yes.
Which is sort of, you know, the thing that makes cuddling feel good is oxytocin. But it's not that simple, because the way that oxytocin feels good is really the endorphin system, the endocannabinoid system, dopamine. Like, there's a lot of, you know, your brain only has so many ways to make you feel good, basically. But oxytocin triggers a lot of those things. And I'd say that the extreme example of this is orgasm. You know, we're at the climax of an orgasm. There is a lot of oxytocin being released, and you feel good. And afterwards, you know, cuddling or snuggling feels good because that oxytocin helps to make sure that a physical connection is rewarding. And where are we getting our oxytocin now? If we're, you know, you're not going to get it from Facebook.
No, you're not. And I mean, on this other level of technology, you talked about being in New York City. You know, I think about like diesel fumes and things like that that you're exposed to, or brake dust. But what are your feelings on just being with a phone and EMF and sort of just the increase? I this is a little fringy, but just like having 50 Wi-Fi signals going through your apartment.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, no, I mean, this was something that I wrote about and researched when I was writing Moody Bitches. And Moody Bitches is a book about women's sort of emotionality and cyclicity and hormones and all the psych meds that women are taking that they maybe don't necessarily need. And I don't know how I ended up on this tangent, but I think in like the Nature chapter, I talked about how much sort of, you know, radiation or microwaves or things like that, that we're being exposed to now. And I also think plastic is not that great for us. And there's a lot of things that we're being exposed to that affect our hormones, or that act as sort of like hormone mimicry that can screw up our endocrine system. So the book is sort of a plea to, you know, back off on the technology and return to nature and to our natural state and what's sort of healthier for us. I think one of the reasons why so many people are taking antidepressants or anti-anxiety meds or sleeping pills or things like that is because of the way that we live our lives. And it's making us stay in this sort of fight or flight mode where we've got a lot of stress. We don't feel held or nurtured or connected. Not just, you know, particulate matter in the air in New York City, but I would also make a case that the noise level with the car alarms and the sirens and the horns and the jackhammers is also not really natural and not great for us. But, you know, I think the biggest thing that's unnatural for us, I will say, as somebody who's very empathically connected. Like, I, you know, I'm a psychiatrist and I feel people's pain for sure. And that's one of the reasons that that I'm a good clinician, is I really care about people and I'm trying to ease their pain. But where was I going with this? I know. So if I open the New York Times and like the picture on the front page or at the top of my email from the New York Times is like, you know, a mother holding her dead baby from an earthquake or something. Yeah. Like, you know, there's a part of me that immediately is like, oh my God, the mother's holding her dead baby. I can't think of anything worse than that. But like every day we are being exposed to other people's traumas all the time, every day, more than ever before. And, you know, when we were cave people or hunter-gatherers on the savannah, maybe in our lifetimes we would see one earthquake or one tsunami or one fire, you know, or one dead baby. But now, like every day, we're being exposed to the traumas all around the world. And for those of us who are empathic,
we're taking the worst news of the day from the planet, basically.
Yeah, like,
here's
the
worst thing that happened on the planet.
Right.
Today.
Here are all the terrible things that happen to other people and could happen to you. So again, you're in this fight or flight mode where you have to be on high alert because these terrible things could happen. But it's not natural, like in the truest sense of the word, nature, and what you would naturally be exposed to if you were living, you know, in the tribal way that we were sort of designed to be living for millennia. I mean, you know, we've got old genes in us, and there's a real mismatch between our genetics and our lifestyles. I mean, you know, our bodies are not meant to be put through this kind of trauma or this kind of stress or this kind of disconnection. And, you know, not only is it bad for our bodies and like the way we feel and our depression, our anxiety, it's actually bad for our brains and making neural connections and thinking and learning. You know, we don't learn well in isolation. There's these really cool experiments where they took a rat And they would shock it so that it would learn, you know, where it got shocked. So it would learn to be afraid of that thing. But then what they did was they would put the rat in isolation in between the learning trials. And what they showed is that if you take the rat away from its friends and its family and stick it in solitary confinement, it doesn't learn. You know, we don't learn in isolation. Our brains don't work right when we're disconnected. And so I would also say that solitary confinement in the prison population, if you think you're trying to teach somebody anything by putting them alone in a cell, it's not going to work. It's not the way we learn. That's not the way our brains make new connections.
Well, yeah, that's a whole thing about whether prison is really about rehabilitation or just profit and punishment. But yeah,
I think you and I are probably in agreement about that.
It sounds like you might be making a prescription for people to have their own foresight. There's no other way. Like, no one's going to do this for you. You kind of have to figure out a way to navigate these different systems that are all sort of emerging around us. So are there sort of some key takeaways from you that you would say these are things that maybe worked for you, or that you find that actually are effective in your practice with people who have some of these symptoms from this stuff?
Yeah. Well, I'm sort of a nudge about a few basic things. And it's all sort of under the umbrella of anti-inflammatory behavior or anti-inflammatory lifestyle. In Moody Bitches, there's a whole chapter called like inflammation is the key to everything. So, states like anxiety or insomnia or depression, these are pro-inflammatory states where you've got a lot of inflammation. In the same way that if you had like rheumatoid arthritis, or diabetes or Alzheimer's or cancer. I mean, there's so many illnesses that have a basis in inflammation. It turns out psychiatric diseases do too. So I talk to my patients a lot about anti-inflammatory lifestyle, anti-inflammatory diet, and that things like yoga and meditation and mindfulness, these are anti-inflammatory practices. Taking probiotics helps to decrease inflammation. Getting exercise, making sure you get tons of sleep. Sleep is anti-inflammatory. I also talk about cannabis because it's a potent anti-inflammatory medicine.
The CBD side of it, or
CBD, even both. THC, they are THC. Both CBD and THC are anti-inflammatory.
Okay.
So I encourage my patients to take vitamin D and probiotics and some sort of cannabinoids, either CBD or a combination of CBD and THC, depending on what they're comfortable doing and what their symptoms are. I talk quite a bit about diet and exercise and sunshine. And I tell people to get off their freaking phones and shut their laptops and like talk to somebody and have eye contact and be held and hug and cuddle, you know, that these things can actually help to make you feel better. They're better for your body than what you're doing now, and they're better for your head. You know, the brain works best when the body is not inflamed. So there are very basic things that you can do to stay healthy that will also really help your mood. And definitely in the winter, you know, I'm on the East Coast, and so winter depression is a very real thing with my patients. And just taking vitamin D throughout the winter can really, really help sort of prevent the bottom from falling out where you get terribly depressed in the winter. And it's also a good anti-inflammatory.
Are you an advocate of sort of a low sugar, more paleo-centered diet?
Yeah, for sure. Right. Yeah. I mean, in Moody Bitches, I say that like flour and sugar are the other white powders. So I'm against most white powders, and sugar and flour, white flour in particular, very high on the list. You know, what you want is to keep your blood sugar stable, and you don't want a big rush of insulin. So, and it turns out that your pancreas views white flour in much the way it views white sugar, that it treats it like a sugar, and there's an insulin surge. So I do encourage paleo or any low carb or any anti-inflammatory diet.
What about things like fish oil? Is that something else that you...
Yeah, so I do recommend that people take fish oils, or just that they eat fish. And you know, I think if you have issues of like irritability or sort of ADHD symptoms, I think that high dose fish oils can be really helpful. And I also think that if you have bipolar disorder, or if your moods are very unstable, that high dose fish oils can help a little bit. But you know, I tend to sort of work with a combination of prescription medicines and plant-based medicines and supplements and things like that. So, I have a lot of people who will use a little bit of both. But my goal is to try to get people to just use supplements and plant-based medicines and not use prescription medicines. But if you have bipolar disorder, if you have schizophrenia, it's going to be really hard to manage all your symptoms with just CBD and diet. But I do have a few people actually who are treating, even their chronic psychotic illnesses with very high dose CBD and not taking prescription meds anymore.
That's fascinating.
But mostly the best that I can do is sort of get a combination of low-dose prescription and high-dose supplements.
Wow. Well, I do want to get into the pharmacopsychology side of this for sure. I mean, that's how you and I were sort of introduced, but I always can get into these other subjects forever. But it's would you say that diet is sort of your starting point, is like maybe one of the biggest ways to make changes?
It's funny because it's one of the things that I talk about with my patients, and I would say 9 times out of 10 they will say something to me like, "You're the first doctor who ever asked me anything about what I eat."
Isn't that
and
crazy?
I'm just like, how stupid and crazy is that? It's like you're treating a machine without knowing what the fuel is. Like, why wouldn't you be like, what are you feeding this thing? Like, it matters. Mm-hmm. It really matters what you eat, when you eat, how you eat. I wrote in Moody Bitches about just again, this idea of fight or flight versus rest and digest. If you want to digest your food and turn it into nutrients, you have to be in this rest and digest mode where you're not tensed up and you're not on high alert. You need to be ultra relaxed and mindful before you eat. And that alone will help you digest. And it also will help you not overeat. If you're, this absent-minded nibbling while you're doing something else is deadly.
Yeah, there's less of a ritual to eating that's sort of probably been built into eating for a millennia of just sort of being with other people or just preparing the food because you had to, or gathering and all these different things that were built into our process of how we process food and the enzymes we create by chewing, and that's all changed.
Right, or even like just if you cook your own food and you're anticipating eating it, your enzymes already sort of kick into gear. So it's everything from the way, from the way we don't hunt, we don't gather, we don't prepare, that affects our metabolism. So, and the other thing that I will talk about if my patients are so inclined is I will talk a bit about, plant teachers, plant medicine. I have a bit of a self-selecting group because I've been sort of outspoken about psychedelics and how I think they can help people for the last 30 plus years now. I mean, basically since the mid 80s, I've been sort of proselytizing about how I think MDMA can help people or cannabis can help people. And then once I heard about ayahuasca or psilocybin, I'm certainly not the only psychiatrist who's talking about this. And it seems to be an ever widening, increasing number of us that are realizing that there's this, a whole sort of category of psychiatric treatment that isn't prescription, big pharma medications that you have to take every single day. For instance, microdosing, where you're taking like a tenth of a sort of trippy dose of LSD or psilocybin, and you can take that like every third or fourth day. And that can help with depression, with anxiety, with ADHD symptoms, with PTSD symptoms. Certainly, I recommend all sorts of cannabinoid medicines for these same sort of diagnoses. And it's all about sort of balancing THC and CBD in terms of what your needs are and what your symptoms are.
So do you find that the psychedelic side of things, the benefits that we're getting is more from the spiritual experience, or would you say it's more from perhaps there's a chemical reaction? For instance, with psilocybin, there's some anecdotal evidence that people feel less depressed and it helps with depression. That may be from the deepening of the psychological, physical, spiritual experience that they go through. But then again, there may be a chemical thing going on in their brain that's actually from the psilocybin. We don't quite know yet, but what do you find?
Well, I definitely, it's very hard to tease apart hardware and software when it comes to things like this.
Right.
And, you know, in the same way that if I was going to give somebody antidepressants or anti-anxiety medicines, I would also want to make sure that they're involved in like weekly therapy or that they're doing something else to address sort of the underlying trauma and issues. You know, it's not just about like, I mean, if you buy a new laptop and you put all your old software on it, you don't really have a new system, you know? And it's like, if you can give all the meds you want, but if you haven't addressed any of your childhood trauma and your history and the way you think about things and your perspective, it's not really going to matter how much meds you take. You know, you really have mm-hmm. to kind of upgrade the hardware and software. And I think that the first thing that comes to mind, you know, with high dose psilocybin or with ayahuasca or something like that, is that you are upgrading the software quite a bit. You are addressing a lot of trauma. You're making sense of your narrative. You're making some decisions about how you've been viewing things and how you want to move forward and change the way you think about things. So I do think that there's a lot of psychological and spiritual sort of reorganization or upheaval that's really therapeutic with these plant teachers. But I also believe and know, and I think this will be borne out over time, is that there are real physiological changes that's happening. I mean, the most exciting thing to me is this idea of neuroplasticity or neurogenesis, where at least in a Petri dish, they have shown that ayahuasca and DMT and psilocybin can cause the sprouting and reconnecting of the brain's sort of branches, the brain cell branches, which are called dendrites or axons.
Dendrites, right? Yeah.
So that they're sort of making new connections, or they're budding or sprouting. And then you're also seeing an actual neurogenesis, where you're seeing new brain cells being formed with these psychedelics. Wow. So it's a really big deal. And one of the things that I love is that the main hormone neurotransmitter that enables neuroplasticity is, wait for it, oxytocin. So there's a real connection here between connection and neuroplasticity and neurogenesis. So I think over time it's going to become clearer exactly how these psychedelics are sort of helping to rewire things. That there's a real physiological connecting and disconnecting of neurons that's happening.
Yes, that's fascinating. And now one thing I think a lot about is, you were talking about the whole systems approach to the psychedelic experience, or just kind of like what helps. It's like, we can't just say it's just the chemical or just the ritual perhaps. And in that line of thought, I think a lot about the role that the ceremony plays. For instance, we know that when you've done simple experiments, you give someone a candy bar and you make them sort of create a ritual out of eating it, like how they wrap it and present it, versus someone who doesn't do that. Their enjoyment of that candy bar is higher. Like, they're like, that was a good candy bar. We do this at restaurants, how they display it and the ritual. And now that was a better meal. You might have the same meal at home. And you're like, oh, it's not as special. And so in some ways, that's a ceremony in itself. And for many, many thousands of years, we were seeing the ceremony, for instance, in a Lakota sweat lodge, like how they do it is exactly how it's always been done. And there's a reason why they do those rituals of, you walk around and clockwise, and, you know, we pour the water this way and we say this song at this time. And I feel like that's part of the technology of the experience that people have figured out for a long time. It's not just mumbo jumbo that they're doing. Like, that's actually part of making it a powerful experience on a cellular and spiritual, psychological level. And I'm hoping that that's not going to be lost. The science is critical. And I noticed, like, some of these studies at Johns Hopkins and so forth, or Imperial College, they have to standardize it, and they're doing it inside a medical setting. And I know they try to dress up the room as best they can, but that's one of the reasons, like, I made this Music for Mushrooms album, is because the music itself is part of that ceremony, and it's sort of the primary guide in the experience. And it has been forever. And we haven't, in my opinion, fully cracked the code, especially for the Western ear, for like a modern person, like how we can use that in a way that can make it even more palatable and powerful for them. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like something, sort of like the role of ceremony in these experiences.
Right. Well, you know, I'm a musician, and I care deeply about music and how it affects my soul and sort of opens me up. And I've spent like my adult life studying drugs and drug taking behavior and the rituals that sort of get created around drug use. And you know, as much as you and I like to think about the rituals, maybe, you know, an ayahuasca ceremony and you know, right, the sage burning and the stating your intention and everybody goes in a circle. But the truth is that there's also rituals around shooting heroin and, mm-hmm, you know, cooking it up in the spoon and putting it through the cotton ball. And, you know, there's, we build up rituals, around drug taking in ways that end up strengthening the experience. And they can take somebody who is an IV drug user and they can watch a movie of somebody sort of cooking up and getting ready to shoot up and show that their brains, like the anticipatory sort of dopamine, even just from watching those cues, is enough to sort of, you know, get somebody in an altered state where they really want that drug. Yes, rituals have power, like 100%. And it is sort of lamentable that the way that we do research in this country is that things have to be sort of commodified and homogenized and standardized so that everybody can do it the same way. And we've got like manuals and protocols for the way that we do it so that everybody can have sort of the same outcome measurements and the studies can have more power. But you know, the people that know and the people that have designed these studies, they know how important the music is. You know, when I was, yeah, working with the NYU psychedelic research group, and they were getting together every week, to read articles and talk about the study protocol, but they also got together on many nights to listen to music and make determinations about what music made the most sense and what music had been used in other studies. And I know Mendel Kaelin, who's in the UK group, he wrote a paper that I think was called like The Hidden Therapist or something, which was just about the music and about how important the music is in these psilocybin studies.
Yeah, I think you shared that paper with me.
It'll make people weep, you know, and it's possible that lying there on high dose psilocybin without the music would be a different experience.
It'd be a different experience. Do you know, like the people who are putting together those playlists, are they doing any research into seeing like what works better than another? Is this just sort of their personal opinion?
Yeah, I mean, as much as they can, you know, it's not like there's a ton out there, but you know, you don't want to reinvent the wheel, right? I mean, there were so many studies done back in the 60s and 70s. And so some of those people were, you know, like Bill Richards is still around. And he can say, you know, this is the music that we used back then. And this was the song where everybody seemed to really start crying. And this seems like an important thing. So we did sort of, you know, stand on the shoulders of giants or whatever, you know, that we built on what had already been sort of figured out from these playlists. A lot of thought went into that. It's certainly for the NYU study, a tremendous amount of thought went into what music was going to be played when. And my assumption is that it was the same in the UK. And I'm pretty sure that those playlists are available online somewhere, but
yeah, they are.
I have to admit, I have not listened to them.
Yeah. Well, can you tell me a little bit about, you know, where the research, I mean, it sounds like you were working more with the MDMA stuff at NYU.
Yeah. Well,
where it's at and where you think it's headed.
Well, first of all, I should just make it clear. I worked at Bellevue for 9 years and I was on the faculty there for 12 years, but I am not officially affiliated with the NYU psychedelic research group now in terms of, you know, I'm not doing the psilocybin studies. I'm the medical monitor for cannabis PTSD studies, which have now wrapped up, and then MDMA PTSD studies, which are ongoing. I was involved in some of the phase two studies, a bunch of them, and now the phase three studies, which are like these multi-center trials, you know, a big multi-center clinical study, phase three, MDMA PTSD. So I'm the medical monitor for that. So my sort of, my role at NYU is just sort of to help it get started. And I called myself like the fairy grandmother of that group, basically. Like I helped get them their initial funding. I helped sort of connect all the people. Like, you're interested in psychedelics. So is this guy. You guys should talk. Why don't we have this guy come over? And then, you know, then they started meeting every week and having, you know, going through papers, and just a great group of people coalesced, and they're doing really good work. And I'm very proud of them and excited for them. And, you know, one of the things that I really try to do is sort of, I'm a connector, you know, I like everybody to get along. I was like the youngest of three kids, and it's my job to sort of like smooth, make sure everybody got along okay. And like, I do a lot of work with drug policy. And there was a time when I was really trying to get like normal and MPP and DPA to all be on the same page with their drug policy things, and like, let's, you know, we're all on the same team, let's all get along, let's all share resources. I feel the same way with the psychedelic community, where, you know, trying to make sure that MAPS and HEFTER and the UK group, that everybody is sort of coordinated and working together, using the same outcome measurements, using the same sort of criteria or the same sample of medicine or the same dosage, just because that makes you have more power, right? If you've got like a bunch of different people doing studies, but they're all doing the same study, you have a lot more power, you know? And so this kind of infighting, we're like, we're going to use this many milligrams, or we're going to use this active placebo, or we're not going to use that outcome measurement. That kind of screws everybody, you know? So it's really important to me that everybody sort of, that everything be transparent, and that everybody share and pool their data as much as possible. As enlightened as everyone is supposed to be with psychedelics, there is still a little bit of like territorial pissings and things that go on, which is a real drag.
Where do you see it headed? I mean, what would you say the timeline is for possible? I mean, I'm more interested in psilocybin, and I've been tracking a lot, but I know where, and I obviously know a bit about where MDMA has been going on for quite a while.
Yeah, so the MDMA definitely sort of got a head start, I think, with psilocybin, and it's been going on for decades. But I think that what's great is that they both got sort of fast-tracked by FDA as breakthrough treatments, which means that you can sort of go faster and use fewer people, and there's a little bit of a lower bar for you know, they've already seen from the phase one or the phase two that there's real efficacy there, and so they agreed, like, yes, this is a breakthrough therapy, this would make a difference. So they're being sort of fast tracked, which is great. My assumption is that MDMA is sort of ahead of the line right now, but psilocybin is moving ahead quickly. You know, there's a lot of rumblings about the sort of capitalism and the financial idea, and this idea of like sort of a intellectual property and patenting and things like this. And it's, I don't necessarily want to wade into that, but I certainly want to acknowledge that there's a real challenge to how to bring these things sort of to market so that they're available to everybody at a reasonable price. It does cost money to do drug development. This is not the kind of thing that's going to be funded by the government, I think it's fair to say. You know, it's all private donors for the MDMA research, for the psilocybin research. Some people want to be able to sort of get out the money that they put in. Other people, probably more of us, want to make sure that like marginalized people have an opportunity to take these medicines and they don't cost an arm and a leg. I don't know exactly how it's all going to shake out. I think most of the people involved have the absolutely sort of best intentions, that they know that these medicines can help a lot of people, and they are trying to help bring these medicines to a lot of people. It's not cheap or easy to develop a medicine, especially one with this kind of, you know, baggage of MDMA or psilocybin.
Have you heard of Compass Pathways, the company?
Yeah, I certainly have.
Speaking of like sort of, you know, lots of grumblings about what's really going on, or, you know, I mean, it's interesting how they're trying to position themselves as a supplier.
Yeah. I mean, interesting is a nice sort of neutral way to talk about what's happening. When I was young, I'm 53 now. And, you know, when I was in my 20s or 30s, I'm a pretty high testosterone person, and I was like antagonistic and confrontational and kind of in your face. I'm just not that way anymore. I don't, you know, you can credit the plant teachers or just I'm old and tired, but like, I am much more about like sort of picking and choosing my battles at this point. And I really try, I don't know if it's like the oxytocin in me or the mother in me or whatever, but like, I just don't have that kind of testosterone anymore. I don't have that kind of yang conflictual energy anymore. I'm really trying to like, assume that people have good interests and that they're trying to do what's best for everybody. When money gets involved, when power gets involved, you know, it just, those things are absolutely drugs. Or, you know, for some people, I would say they're sort of aphrodisiacs. Like, you know, people really get off on having power, on having exclusivity, on having money. I don't, you know, I don't want to get too bogged down. I really sort of come back to like, you know, we are all on the same team. We should all be on the same page. We all want the same things. You know, let's not fuck it up. I mean, it doesn't take much to, for this whole thing to just break down.
Yeah, it's sort of a nascent fragile thing that's emerging, and it is moving faster and faster, which can sometimes cause, there can be some missteps.
But you know, you and I know that it is not that hard for people to grow their own mushrooms. It is not, it's even easier for people to grow their own cannabis. And you know, it's, yeah, it is subversive and sort of democratizing if we can just say, hey, everybody should just be able to grow their own medicine and take their own medicine. We don't need the government. We don't need FDA involved. That is a stance that I take frequently. And it is not a popular stance among other physicians. You know, you know, most doctors seem pretty comfortable with like FDA and pharmacies and insurance. And like, that's just, that's how we all work. You know, the truth is that everybody could be growing their own plant medicines.
Yeah. Well, when I was in Oregon, certainly you had that option. Now, if you want to grow a few plants, if you're, you know, it's not so easy to do outdoors. I guess you could get maybe one crop in the summer. The point is, like, that's actually pretty viable, not that challenging of an option if you're into that kind of stuff. But
right, and I mean, even one crop in the summer, though. I mean, you know, you can have two or three plants, and for some people, that's really like enough cannabis for the year.
And there's got to be a beautiful connection to just like gardening. It's like,
right. Well, it's like, you know, I mean, we love being like locavores and eating local, you know, like, oh, you know, this cheese was farmed from the cows in the next town. And this, it's like, well, you know, this cannabis was grown in my backyard. Like, that's locavore.
It's, yeah.
You know, and you feel connected and you feel really connected with the earth. You know, I think, first of all, just gardening anything, like the act of gardening is healthy and therapeutic. There's no question. That's going to put you into the rest and digest and repair mode. You know, just gardening and being on earth time and not sort of man-made time and partnering, you know, with the planet to make your food or to make your plant medicines. Like, that is a therapeutic connection. You talk about being connected, you know, as much as I talk about somebody holding you or hugging you, what about feeling connected with the earth? Or what about when you're tripping and you feel connected with everything, connected with the cosmos? You know, everything is connected and I am part of that. Like, that's a really high oxytocin state. That's a peak experience. It's profound. That is therapeutic. And you have a little taste of that anytime, you know, even if I just like go out to my deck and I pick off a couple of sprigs of oregano before I go inside to cook something, like even just that moment of pulling those leaves off the plant and sort of thanking the plant. And that's how I start my meal, is by something that's growing, you know, in the dirt in my property. Like, I feel connected to the earth, and that's therapeutic. That is that same kind of high oxytocin connected state that I could get if, you know, I was cuddling with my mother.
Isn't it crazy that sort of the solutions to a lot of our ailments have to do with remembering that which has always been there?
Right. Yeah. Uncovering and going back. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's some idea of learning that real learning is just remembering, you know, that you're like, yeah, I kind of already knew that. That appeals to me because I'm a know-it-all and I like to know everything ahead of time before anybody tells it to me. Like, I see where you're going with this. I already know what you're saying. Which is a great quality in a therapist, by the way, and a psychiatrist. Okay, I got it. I see. I know what you're saying already. You don't have to. You don't have to talk anymore. It is all sort of in our genes. You know, how to connect, how to sort of be one with somebody, or be one with the earth, or be one with the cosmos. I think that stuff is sort of, you know, baked in or hardwired into our genetics already. And it is sort of just going back to the old ways and seeing that as much as technology does amazing things to help us, it is also disconnecting us.
Well, I feel for kids who are growing up in certain ways where they don't even know, where they have such a disconnection, and they're going to have to start from a different place as an adult to try to rediscover these things that they maybe never had growing up. And God knows what it does to any of our brains, let alone one that's developing.
Yeah. Oh, you know, I said something before about how, like, we don't, you know, we're not getting oxytocin from Facebook. And the truth is, I don't know. And maybe we are, but it certainly wouldn't be the same as what we're getting between people. But I did come across really interesting study when I was researching Moody Bitches about computer porn that showed that in the same way that if two people are having sex and one or both people has an orgasm, you know, orgasm triggers a release of oxytocin, because in nature, I mean, it's like a lot of women have trouble climaxing. And if a man is going to, or whatever, whoever your partner is, man or woman, doesn't matter, but like whoever your sexual partner is, if they paid enough attention to you and made you so relaxed and open and comfortable that you climax, then you have this surge of oxytocin, and that helps you connect to that person. Like, there's somebody that's probably worth connecting to because they really made you feel good and safe, and, you know, you had this great experience. Mm-hmm. So nature gives you oxytocin to help bond with whoever brought you off, basically. But what happens when you jerk off to porn, and you ejaculate, you still get a little bit of the oxytocin surge because you just climax. And so what are you bonding with? You're bonding with your laptop. Like, if that doesn't scare you, especially when you realize that oxytocin enables neuroplasticity. So every time you're jerking off to porn, your brain is sort of getting a little bit more specific about what arouses it, you know, and the fetish gets a little bit more specific on what's great about, you know, whatever Pornhub you're searching through, is that you can search for more and more specific things that'll arouse you. But if you think that jerking off to porn with more and more discrete things that arouse you and having that oxytocin release, if you think that that's not restructuring your brain, you're delusional.
Yeah, that seems pretty obvious. I think the next level of that is what that does to you. You know, it's one thing. Some people might be like, well, you know, so be it. That feels good and that's easy and it's there. But then it's like, well, how's that bleeding into the rest of your life? Maybe how your emotions or your moods. And that's right.
Or maybe it means that when you have sex with a person, you're not that aroused and you need to take Viagra.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't know. It's interesting to think about the porn industry in general. Why is it massive? And is that because we're not giving ourselves what we need, or is it because we have needs that are so enormous, or is it just because it's sort of like a virus that just took over because it's available? And like you're saying, it's an easy drug.
It is easy. It's, you know, I'm sort of thinking about fast food again, and what we were talking about, you know, where when you kill your food, when you prepare your food, and you're really invested in it, you have a different experience. And like, you know, the truth is that, like, finding someone that is attracted to you that you're also attracted to, and then getting them to, like, come back to your place and have sex with you, like, all of that takes a certain amount of work and preparation and risk and arousal. And it's, you know, porn is like fast food of sex. You know, it's just like it's way more plentiful than we need. It does not mimic any sort of natural conditions. You know, like, if you were out in the savannah and the tribe, you maybe would have a handful of sex partners. You know, you would have your choice of maybe 20 or 30 mates, and you would find two or three of them attractive. But like now with internet porn, you have your choice of, you know, thousands of, like, quote, sex partners or scenarios, or, you know, there's a smorgasbord that is unnatural.
Yeah.
And it changes sort of what we think of as normal. It it creates a new threshold, you know, for what will arouse you, what you need to arouse you, what is considered normal. And sometimes that's a little bit incompatible with reality.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it probably does not help the long-term health and wellness of committed relationships, certainly monogamous ones. I would just think it makes it perhaps, some people would say it makes it harder because you're making sort of your needs be changing in this, or your diversity. And some maybe would say, oh, it's an outlet to stay in monogamy because you're able to, in a quote, safe way.
Right.
Have that variety, that novelty.
Yeah. So novelty, monogamy, internet porn, I wrote about all of these things in Moody Bitches. I went down like a lot of different rabbit holes when I was researching that book. And I felt like, you know, any one of those topics could be a whole book in and of itself. And if you want to talk about monogamy and novelty and fidelity, you're really talking about the balance between oxytocin and testosterone. People forget that women also have testosterone, but both women and men have this sort of, you know, I think of it as kind of like a yin yang balance, with oxytocin being sort of on the yin tendon befriend side, and then testosterone being sort of on the yang fight or flight side. But everybody has their own proprietary blend of these hormones, and they sort of compete. Testosterone is all about novelty, and conquest, and oxytocin is about trust and bonding and fidelity. And really interesting, interesting to me. All of this stuff is really interesting to me. That there are certain animals, there are certain like prairie dogs, prairie voles, and some are monogamous and some are polyamorous. And it really has to do with like one group has oxytocin receptors and the other group doesn't. So this idea of oxytocin having sort of being like the pharmacological basis of fidelity. And testosterone really has a lot to do with novelty and infidelity.
So where's that balance you're speaking of, where you say it's a relationship between the two as far as monogamy and health in relationships?
Well, I think, first of all, people have to decide what their priorities are and what's important to them. You know, not everybody thinks that monogamy is the absolute sort of non-negotiable sine qua non of a relationship. I mean, I think more and more now people understand that not everybody is built that way. A lot of us are really aroused by novelty, or we're aroused by transgression. So, you know, even if the rule is monogamy, there's still going to be a lot of sort of adrenaline and arousal and kind of reinforcing brain hormones around novelty and transgression. And you know, I think the most important thing is that if you are in a partnership with somebody, that you guys have to just be on the same page. Like, what are the rules? Like, you know, what can we get away with? What do we want? What are we willing to give up for getting what we want? And it's a, you know, I said proprietary blend again when talking about something else, but I think it is this sort of like intellectual property of a relationship that you guys are going to decide together. What are the rules? And you can make your own rules. You know, I have a lesbian friend, and the rule with them is like, well, if we're traveling, like if one of us is at a conference and like we want to get with somebody, then that's okay. You know, just to, don't bring it home. It's like, oh, that's one way to play it. There's all sorts of different ways to play it. And like, you know, does the other person want to know? Maybe they actually do want to know and they want to hear stories about it because it arouses them. Other people are like, I don't care what you do, but I don't want to know about it. And then other people are like, you can't ever, you know, do that or we're going to break up. And I also think, you know, this is something I have an 18-year-old daughter who's a freshman in college now. And she, I think, was really fed by the movies she watched, by the TV shows she watched. You know, she's really got this idea that like monogamy and fidelity is the absolute bedrock of a relationship. And if you don't have that, you don't have anything. But she's a freshman in college where like, you know, she's with other people who are really exploring, you know, not mating, but just dating. And there's really a physiological difference between those two things. And like, you know, looking for a boyfriend is not the same thing as looking for a husband and father for your kids. And, you know, she is going to have to sort of navigate that. Not everybody has sort of bought into that narrative, you know, that well, yeah, like it's like days, fidelity or nothing. Generation. You know, Esther Perel is sort of the queen of writing and talking about monogamy versus infidelity and, you know, what people need and what they want. Her last book, State of Affairs, I thought was really, really well written and very well received. And the one before that called Mating in Captivity, which I thought was mm-hmm. a great title. You know, it really has a lot, this idea of safety, it's not very arousing to be safe and to be cuddling, right? And if you're held and you're safe and you're connected, that's really good for your body and it's good for your head and you've got oxytocin and it's anti-inflammatory and you've got neuroplasticity. That's all great. But you're not horny in that state necessarily. You know, there's no sort of spark. There's no tension. You know, there's no adrenaline. There's no transgression. It's not sexy. It's comfortable and it's safe, but that's not necessarily going to sort of, you know, get people off. And so then the issue is like, what kind of danger or edge can you bring to the relationship where you have both safety and connection and, you know, fire and passion? And that's, you know, what she tried to tackle in Mating in Captivity. It's really, really hard. Like, why do you think half of marriages end? You know, it's really challenging to stay together and to balance the sort of, you know, like, do you want to cuddle tonight or, you know, do you want a quickie or like, you know, and it, the thing is, it has to start with just talking about it, being honest with yourself about what you want, what arouses you, what are your requirements, and being honest with the other person about those things.
Well, yeah, I mean, talk about maybe it not feeling sexy is when it becomes a calendar or a conversation, these sorts of things. But you're right, at the end of the day, it is about communication because you can't read people's minds and their needs yeah. are moving from day to day, certainly right. week to week.
Oh, well, definitely for a woman, her yeah. desires are really going to, if she's not on the pill and she's free range and she's cycling, she's going to have very different ideas about, you know, what she's looking for on any given night. And you just have to be able to talk about it. So free range is one of the things yes. that I talked about in Moody Bitches about women who aren't taking birth control, who have got naturally cyclical hormones.
Yeah.
It really changes how desirous you're going to be. If you're mid-cycle and you're fertile, you're going to be a lot more horny. You're going to have a lot more testosterone on board. And then once the egg is died and you're kind of in this dead egg phase of the second half of the cycle, you're just, you know, not as interested.
Well, maybe people could just get more tapped into their, a woman's cycle. I mean, isn't it true that in Jewish traditions and Orthodox, like traditionally when a woman's on her quote moon time, they give her space, like physically, like they basically leave for like a week.
Right. Well, there's this whole idea of the red tent. And I think yeah. that in some kibbutzes in Israel also that the menstruating woman would just sort of go to one area and hang out. I would be perfectly happy to be sent to Siberia for a week every month. Like I definitely, it's funny because I mean, I have really noticed that there's a time in my cycle where I'm like very, very attracted and attached to my husband, Jeremy. And then there's other times in my cycle where I'm not. And like, that's nature and that's natural. And, for both of us to sort of be aware of that is incredibly helpful. Of course, you know, when you're perimenopausal or menopausal, all bets are off about like this, the cycle just becomes very erratic. But all through your 20s, 30s, and most of your 40s, you know, if you're not on the pill, you are cycling and you're going to have this up and down desire for connection and communion. It's not static.
Yeah, that takes a lot of self-knowledge to walk through that as a couple. And I wonder how much people are struggling with that. Because I know as you talked about, I'm still coming up with this phrase about the balance between testosterone and oxytocin.
Yeah.
And I'm still thinking about that in my mind as how people can work with that in a practical way to deal with this idea of attraction and stability. And maybe they're fighting between the two things and it's a hard thing for a lot of people to navigate and talk about because there's yeah. not a lot of good information.
Well,
out there.
I like to talk about it in terms of like yin yang, because I think that that's something that a lot of people sort of can understand that all of us have sort of feminine energies and masculine energies. And then it's all that we need to balance them within ourselves and then between us in relationship.
Yeah. Well, it is a poetic topic. I mean, it's not something where there's like a clear answer. It's like do this or do that. But I know it's a moving target. So,
yeah.
But I love that it's something that you're into. It's great to talk about. Just one last thing I wanted to ask you about from before. In the work with psychedelic therapy, and particularly when you're working with people, this role of integration, and I know they're doing these studies and they do some follow-ups. And do you have any tips or tricks or kind of pitfalls you think people could be looking out for as a way of really making this work stick? So it's not just sort of an escapism in a sense, but how do you make it the most valuable? So
integration is just a huge, huge topic. I'm actually, there's a conference at Esalen the first week in April that I'm going to be speaking at, which is all about integration. And you can have integration on a personal level where you sort of accept your dark side, you know, that you know that there are things about you that bring you shame or that make other people uncomfortable, but you have to sort of accept them and integrate them into the whole of you so that you can be a personally integrated person. So that's one level of integration. But, you know, there's also integration like in a community. For instance, with the psychedelic communities having a bit of like a Me Too moment where there's some transgressors who have had some like sexual misconduct. And some people want to sort of shun those people and, you know, deplatform those people. And then there's others of us, myself included, who feel like shunning and ostracism does not do anything to sort of fix the problem or fix the community. It's the opposite of integration. You know, we need to sort of rehabilitate these people and teach these people and have them better. And, you know, we need to integrate them into the community and show them how we want them to act. And that's what's healthier. So I think, you know, everywhere you look, there is sort of integration versus segregation or disconnection. It's everywhere. And it is, you know, I think like inflammation, I think integration is the key to everything, that we need to be more integrated with our environment and understand, you know, that we are part of the ecology and that our behavior affects the ecology because it is all integrated, it is all connected, it is all one thing. You know, the planet is one organism and humanity is one organism. And we need to be integrated, all of us as humans need to be sort of integrated with, you know, the whole human team. And we need to be integrated in our partnerships. That's sort of the idea with like the yin-yang balance. You know, between two people, not just within one person. So it's integration is a huge issue. I think it's the basis of health. You know, the word like healthy comes from whole or holy, and it's this idea of wholeness, which is this idea of integration. So health is all about integrating. It's about integrating, you know, our most basic and basest desires with sort of the high holiness of what we think we should be doing. And it's a tall order. It's a tough nut to crack. I spent a lot of time talking about it. I think it's trending, I would say. You know, it's a hot topic.
It's trending. Yes,
trending.
Yes, yes.
But it's definitely kind of what it's all about. And I know that it has a very specific meaning in the psychedelic community, which is sort of like whatever you just learned from your last trip, you need to actually walk the talk, you know, and that's sort of how we think of integration. And that is important. You know, I think of it, it's like, it's almost like if you take a huge bite of a big, you know, submarine sandwich or a hoagie or hero, whatever you want to call it. But like you take a huge bite and then you have to sit and chew, swallow. And like, that's integration. You know, you come away from an ayahuasca ceremony or high dose psilocybin or LSD, and you've got like, oh my God, like I just figured out this, that, and this. It's like, that's great, but you figured it out. But like, what are you going to do with that information? How are you going to put it into practice? How are you going to actually like weave it into your operating system? You know?
Yeah, that's where the rubber hits the road.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the $1 million question. But
and that's really what matters. And so hopefully that's what we'll all be talking about at Esalen in a few weeks.
Very cool. Well, Esalen's wonderful. I'll be out there in June. And it's funny, just before we were talking, I was filling out my little proposals for 2020 at Esalen. Cool.
Yeah, it's my first time going, but hopefully it won't be my last.
Oh my God, you're going to love it.
I know. I can't wait.
One of the most beautiful places on the planet. And I've been around Big Sur. So I was like,
yeah, well, I've been to Big Sur too. But you know, it's not just like the beauty of Big Sur. It's also just like, you know, being naked in a hot tub with like Rick Doblin and Michael Pollan. Like that'll be fun, right? Paul Stamets, like it's going to be exciting.
That will be fun. That will definitely be fun. And it is uniquely beautiful, like the landscaping hugging the side of the cliff. It's the edge of America.
So I'm really looking forward to being there.
Nothing like that.
So speaking of Rick Doblin, I got to go get on a MAPS conference call for the phase 3 MDMA PTSD studies. All right.
Well, hey, listen, how can people find you and your work?
Don't find me. No, you can look around, but please don't email me. Please don't find me. So, let's see. DrHolland.com is probably the easiest way to find me, but it's, if you just like Google Julie Ecstasy, you'll find me. Like it's very easy to find me. Yeah. Okay. When I used to meet people at parties in the '90s, I'd be like, just Google Julie Ecstasy and you'll find me. And it still works. So I kind of like that. My name is Julie Holland. But there is more than one Julie Holland out there, but it turns out there's only one Julie Ecstasy. So drholland.com or at Bellevue Doc, I guess, for Twitter. But, you know, I'm easy to find. There's lots of stuff.
Okay, I'll put it in the show notes. And look, I had a great time talking with you. There's more I'd love to explore. Maybe
yeah,
in the
we can do this again.
We'll get into it again sometime.
We only scratched the surface, I believe. I think we have lots more to talk about, especially about we need to talk more about you next time. You.
It's not so much about me, but I'm here. I love just getting into people's worlds. And that's, I think, as I mentioned to you in the email, it's like, this is always just a great excuse for me to get to know people. And so it's wonderful. I love it.
All right. It was my pleasure to talk. I got to run. Well,
have a great day. Thanks.
All right. You too.
Well, thank you, Julie, for giving us your time. I do look forward to chatting again. And yeah, she's got some stuff out there. I know she doesn't want you to email her. I can vibe that. But she's busy, folks. She's a busy woman. But she does have an interesting nexus point of information out there. And I'm sure we'll cross paths again. This song that you're hearing in the background is called Washed, or at least it's currently called Washed. And it's actually an advanced look at that Music for Mushroom albums that I've been talking about so much. This is an abbreviated track of one of the songs. Currently track number 11. And I'm in the process of mastering that record right now with Taylor Dupree, one of my favorite mastering engineers for this kind of work. And just getting that stuff ready for you guys. Ready to share in early May is the plan right now. We're also putting together a limited edition number of ceremony boxes as a way of presenting that album. It will be digitally released, but there's no physical form other than these boxes because it's a 5-hour record. And then the box is things like, it's like a ceremony kit. Crystals and my scents and my organic smoke blend and journals and an instruction card and some artwork and an eye shade and so forth and so on. Things for you to dive into yourself. So that'll be coming soon. Keep your eyes out. That'll be a limited edition box, each one numbered and signed. And if you want one of those, it's a fantastic way to support the work. And it'll be a really nice keepsake or gift to someone. Okay, say hi if you like. info@eastforest.org. If you want to host a listening gathering for the March 22nd Chapter 2, reach out. We'll help you. Let's do this. Let's do our things and keep doing it well. It is a mystery being a human being, and we're all walking, and we're just asking for more grace. Please, 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 more grace, more grace, more grace, more love. Keep walking your walk. May the forest be with you. Don't take any shit, but if you do, do it with grace, folks. Shut up.
Sure.